It is just a big mini, isn't it? You fiddle the system even there.
I forgot my own brief, to be honest, but yes.
Welcome to the best planned podcast on YouTube.
Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the Classics World Chat Show, a collective candy store of conversation, shall we say. So, as ever, I'm joined by my co-host, Jeff Ruggles.
Hello.
And Joe Miller.
Hello, you're just getting better and better at this.
It's keeping this going. It's going to be the problem, isn't it? It's going to be a challenge, I think, every week. But
I'll make a point of not taking a mouthful of coffee when we do these.
Any suggestions in the comments are most welcome, please. That'd be very good. But anyway, well, look, we're not recording this that far from when we did the previous episode, for scheduling reasons. But I think there's still some news that we would like to discuss. So, Jeff, hot off the press.
Yeah,
we just had a statement in from the HCVA about electric vehicle conversions of classics.
Yes, from the Historic Classic Vehicle Alliance. So it concerns electric vehicles, as you say, and they've sort of brought out a framework, which is a sort of minimum professional standards that they believe that these electric vehicle conversions on classics should meet, which I think is quite a sensible idea because, yeah, it's unregulated really at the moment, isn't it?
And it's major safety concerns, yeah.
Well, exactly that. So, I mean, I know various firms converting vehicles. I'll give one example of Felton, based near Bristol, and I know that they're extremely meticulous in the way they convert and they're very, very safe indeed. But it's an industry that could be opened up to abuse in that way.
I bumped into Dale at the HCVA, who's doing an excellent job heading the organisation up, talking about this very thing, because I think we can all agree that electric conversions of classic cars is not without its controversy, because some people see it as absolute heresy that anyone would even contemplate this. But as we discussed at that time, Dale and I sort of concluded that the problem is that if you simply just shun it and say it's a terrible idea, it will happen anyway. It's arguably appealing to a different market, to the dyed-in-the-wall classic car enthusiast anyway. So the market there will be someone that loves the appeal of the retro styling, but modern green powertrains. And I will put that in parentheses for those that sort of will question about electric vehicles in general. But anyway, there will be people that want them. So it's probably in the HCVA's interest and the wider sector, I think, to embrace the fact that they exist and then try and bring everyone up to a consistent standard to ensure consistency of quality and safety. So I think it's really sensible next steps, and it's great to see HCVA really getting stuck in on something like this.
Yeah, I mean, we should also point out they're doing excellent work on sustainable fuels. And they're doing excellent work in various other areas of the sector to promote the internal combustion engine. So it's quite a multifaceted approach. And it's along with the Federation trying to ensure that we're able to drive the cars of yesteryear tomorrow.
Yeah, I think it's a great approach to take. I mean, the angle I've kind of taken on EV converted classics of late is, if a company came out now with a brand new electric vehicle, but that looked like a Countach or a Golf GTI or a Testarossa or whatever.
Or how about a Renault 5?
Or a Renault 5, exactly. That's what I was going to make.
Oh, wait, that's happened.
People would pore over it. And I think that's kind of how my approach to it. It's not necessarily for me, but that doesn't mean it's not for someone.
On slightly sort of sadder news, I think we've just found out that John Backus has passed away, who was the author of the Viking and the Samurai book that we've referenced in previous episodes of the chat show, and of course was very much instrumental in those British Leyland Austin Rover days throughout the late 70s and throughout the 80s.
He was a real key factor in the Honda relationship, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was the main man in charge of it, effectively. Yeah. That's where that book kind of is written from his perspective. So yeah, our condolences to friends and family on that one.
If you've not read the book, I urge you to do so as a nod and an appreciation to John and his work. It's a really measured, calm recollection of those days, which we must all, I think, run the risk of sort of talking it down as a disastrous time for the British car industry. But actually, it was merely a fresh direction for an industry that clearly had its troubles throughout the 60s and 70s. And I think his account is excellent, because it shows you the real realities, I suppose, of making cars in that modern era against huge and growing global competitions. So sorry to see John go. And like you say, Joe, condolences to his friends and family. But do go and check out the book.
His son Richard has always been incredibly helpful working on the archive desk at British Motor Museum. So yeah, condolences to Richard and his family.
Yes, but yeah, go and check out the book. We'll move on to our buying roundup. We've done 80s icons in an episode a little while ago, so we thought we'd skip back a couple of decades and look at the 1960s. Was that really the kind of the halcyon days of modern motoring for the masses, where you could get anything from a Mini to a Ferrari? And I don't know, it probably feels like the most glamorous time before safety legislation and such like gets involved and starts to tell designers how you can design a car. I should just preface that some of that safety legislation has been quite instrumental in improving road safety, so we shouldn't diss it entirely. But no doubt that before those things came in, you know, I think car design was probably freer, and we were probably at an era where speed limits and seatbelts were also a kind of a rough guideline.
The other thing I thought was interesting about this topic is that for a lot of you watching and listening of a certain generation, you will still think of 60s cars as being, quote, proper classics, and might not think of something like a late 80s or a 90s car as being a true classic car. So it's interesting to see, with the boom in prices of a lot of 60s stuff, that between the three of us, we've come up with a lot of 60s cars that are actually still quite affordable. And I think of our choices, all the choices we made, at least two of them are available. We said under 20 grand, but I think we've all kind of snuck under the 10 grand barrier in most cases. So this is proof, if you want to get into a proper classic, they're not necessarily as unaffordable as you might imagine.
It's a market of opportunity, is what I'm
absolutely
saying. Because you know, the vogue is moving towards 80s, 90s classics amongst sort of 40-somethings with disposable income. And that makes those older classics from the 60s, it makes them really, really good value.
The 60s cars had their boom time sort of 10 or so years ago, but now it's kind of a buyer's market in a lot of cases. So should we dive in?
I think so. So Jeff,
you always make me start, didn't you?
First choice.
Predictably, I'm going for a Ford. You know, I like a Henry. And I'm going to go for a car that I think was extremely significant. And that is the Mark I Ford Cortina. A product of Ford of Britain. It was developed in under 2 years. And it was just a brilliant example of Ford's ability to take fairly standard ingredients, combine them in a package with excellent little stylish touches, like the iconic rear lights and chrome touches. It had a comfortable interior, modern engines, but really the layout was nothing groundbreaking. Rear wheel drive, when BMC were coming up with all their front wheel drive cars, it was just a huge hit and an incredible example of getting it right in such a short development period. And of course, you had your standard models, you had the estate 2-door and 4-door saloons, but you also had the GT and of course the Halo Lotus model. So it not only was a car that you saw on every street corner, but it dominated saloon car racing, and what incredible success, you know. And then it was only 4 years old when it was completely redesigned again, you know, and they brought out the boxy Mark II. So it was Ford's showing its ability to be ahead of the curve and to keep things fresh, even when you could argue they probably didn't need to. And I just think it's a hugely significant car that, of course, led to the Mark III, IV, V, then the Sierra, then the Mondeo. And of course, that sector doesn't really exist anymore in that way. But for a good 50 years, it was Ford leading the way. And this is where they got started, because at the beginning of the 60s, they didn't really have a mid-sized family car. You had the Anglia and you had the big three Graces, you know, the Zephyr, Zodiac and Consul. And the Cortina was a revelation for them, really.
It's one of the coolest family saloons, certainly of its period. I mean, what can you pay for a Mark I Cortina now?
I think if you wanted a non-sporting version, you could probably sneak one for under 10k, but you know, a GT or a Lotus is going to be significantly more, especially a Lotus.
See, in the world of classic Fords though, less than 10 grand is fairly cheap actually.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it would be a challenge to find one for that money, but like we say, they're probably those basic cars are getting a little bit cheaper.
I think it's a really good choice, and as you said, it's Ford doing what it does best, building something that's fairly basic in terms of its mechanicals, but then you set model trim ranges to suit every budget and aspiration. So, you know.
But in that market, you know, a fleet and family market, you need something simple. You just want it to work. And that's what they were so good at.
Well, I'm reading a book at the moment about British Leyland and all that kind of stuff. And there's no coincidence that one of the BL plans in the 70s was to try and Fordize the range, I think was the sort of verb they went for, where they were trying to make it much more uniform. And it's kind of one of the reasons I think the Marina was what it was, because I think they wanted something basic and dependable and be more Cortina like. We can argue whether it was successful or not, but it was definitely that strategy that they tried to mimic.
Yeah, simple but effective. I think that's the key to its success.
I've got a very small anecdote, if I may, about Mark I Cortina, which I must share. When I was a kid, my uncle had a Mark I Cortina. It was black and it was on the driveway of my grandfather's house at the time, and me and my brother were just sitting in it pretending we were driving it. And then I got out and left my two-year-old brother in the passenger seat, and my cousin or something got into the driver's seat and then proceeded to let the handbrake off, and then it rolled off the driveway and dropped a meter and a half off the end of the driveway into a garden path. with my younger brother sitting in his Mark 1 Cortina sort of cradling off the edge of this precipice. But a very good, iconic, worthy example of a 60s classic, Jeff, as ever, a man of taste. Go on in, Joe, follow that answer.
Perfectly, my first choice is arguably the arch rival to the Cortina, certainly back then, the BMC 8016, better known as the 1100-1300 if you're not quite as nerdy as us. Austin, Morris, MG, Riley, Wolseley, I think there might have been an Inocenti as well. Every badge in Britain pretty much was put on the thing, but whatever it wore, it was fabulous. Gorgeous bit of design. It looked like a sort of shrunken down Big Farina. Very, very pretty car. Modern in the Isagonist engineered sense, front wheel drive, transverse, very nicely packaged. So for a small car, it's really quite roomy inside. Had hydroelastic suspension, handled and drives like a big Mini, and that's no bad thing. They're brilliant to drive. They look gorgeous. Again, they're just like a sort of 20% bigger Mini in every way. And as a family car, that works brilliantly. They did sporting version. You get your MGs and your 1300 GTs. They did the posh kind of luxury Vandenplas versions. They did an estate version as well. They're just wonderful. I think they're one of the best everyday cars to come out of the 60s. And to say nothing of the fact that they're still supported incredibly well. There's companies like ADO Restoration and Heritage can still do everything for the A series, which is, we know is a great engine. And you can still get into one for relatively affordable money. I think for $5,000, you could put one in your driveway. You could get a roadworthy ADO 16 for $5,000. And I think for what you get and the fun you get, I think they're a bit of a bargain to boot. Fabulous car.
It was Britain's best-selling car for many, many years for a reason, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
I think it's a really good concept.
What I would say is if any of you listening haven't driven one because you're not old enough or you haven't driven one for a long time, go down to Drive Dad's Car at the Great British Car Journey because they've got a mint 1300 GT there, which we've featured in videos. Go and buy a drive in it because it's fabulous and you will understand the hype. They're brilliant.
That is the sad thing behind them, isn't it? The reason they don't really exist anymore is corrosion. You know,
yeah, they rot badly.
They were really bad for it. There are lots of cherished survivors now, so that it's not so much of an issue.
Yeah, I think it's a great choice. They look great. They've got this timeless design about them, which is really good.
Still, for a 60s car, still very affordable.
Yep. No, agreed. Well, my first choice is a Rover P6.
Oh, round of applause, sir. Fantastic.
It straddles the 60s and the 70s, actually. But again, the book I'm reading makes a slightly bold claim, which I would invite comment on such a claim, that the Rover P6 is probably one of the greatest post-war British cars ever made. Now, I think it's quite a lofty claim. I'm not sure I'd sign off on
that. It's a great car.
I don't think that is a lofty claim. I think that's fairly well-founded.
You can't deny the design and the engineering of that car is probably peak. Having now driven one, it was just delicious. The way it rode and drove, it was smooth, it was elegant. I interviewed someone at Bromley the other week in the arena, and he dailies his one, daily drives it. And he says, I said, he meant to buy it as a kind of Sunday car, but actually he sold his modern car and never got around to replacing it. So now he's just using this thing every day.
Brilliant.
You think, what an absolute hero. For those watching us on YouTube, I'd just like to point out my new addition to my wall at the back there, which is actually a Rover P6 hubcab that's now a clock.
I think that's brilliant.
And that's my lovely little tribute to the Rover P6 and everything that's great about it. And I know everyone might hanker after the V8, but to me, that the regular engine is just fine. And
they're no less of a car with the four-cylinder in. They're
yeah,
still
absolutely. Yeah, 100%. So
I think you can make a good case for the P6 being one of the most criminally undervalued classics. The sort of money you can pay for one. What, few grand?
They always end up in those roundups of affordable classics, don't they? Because you do get an awful lot of car for a relatively modest outlay.
Yeah, I'm going to make a bold claim that is the British Citroen DS. I think it is a fabulous, fabulous car. Love
them. Nice. Okay. I'll go with that. Go on then, Jeff. Number two.
Another car. Yes. Okay. This is the sports car, right?
Yeah.
So I have...
I forgot my own brief, to be honest, but yes.
You just give me a nudge here, will you? it's already been
Welcome
a long morning.
The best planned podcast on YouTube.
Yes. So I'm going for something a little bit left field, and I'm going to pick the Honda S800.
Nice.
Oh, niche.
So Honda didn't make its first production road car until 1963. And the S800 was kind of an evolution of that. So they first started with the S500, the S600, and then the S800, which made its debut at the Tokyo Show in 65, I believe. And we didn't get them until sort of 66 and mostly 67. But here was a car with sort of 791 cc's that could do 100 miles an hour, rev to 11k, and did 35 miles to the gallon.
Crazy.
Early ones had independent rear suspension, all for the price that was less than a Triumph Spitfire. You know, I know they were tiny, but that is remarkable, isn't it? And it's kind of that genesis of how Honda wowed us all with high revving, incredibly well-engineered sports cars.
Yeah.
Sadly, it had a double overhead cam engine that was deemed a little bit too dirty for the US market that it needed to really succeed in. So the last cars were sold in 1970. So it wasn't around for long. And if you want one now, you know, they made a Roadster and a coupe. And if you want one now, you're going to have to spend over 20 grand, probably. So I've slightly missed the brief there. But, you know, what a machine. A tiny little car that, you know, took on the midget and Sprite and yet could do over 100 mile an hour.
Incredible. That's such a cool choice. I mean, you can see now when you see that, how you end up at the Honda Beat that I love from the 90s, you know, mid-engine individual throttle bodies, that revs to 9,000 or so. Yeah, I can see the lineage there. That's what a great choice.
Super cool. They're super cool and I can't afford one.
I think it would suit you. It would suit you very much.
And it's a really good choice, Jeff. Very left field, but so utterly on point. So yeah, very good. Joe, are you going to be able to match that, sir?
Well, on paper, no. My sports car of choice, because we're family car, now we're going sports car, is effectively, Jeff sort of hinted at it already, would have been a British rival to the S800, the MG Midget, which I still maintain is about the most fun you can have in a car. They are wonderful. If you ever wonder what it's like to be in Alice in Wonderland, where she shrinks and the whole world's growing around her, go and drive an MG Midget on modern roads, because suddenly you're next to these enormous cars with these wheels towering over you, and then you realize it's a Mark 7 Fiesta. Yeah, the midget makes the whole world feel enormous. There's nothing to them in any dimension, but that's what makes them so fun. They're so basic and so light and so small. And the early ones, everything was an optional extra. And, you know, the windows were sliding bits of Perspex and what have you. But for pure driving fun, 60-odd horsepower, rear-wheel drive, minimal weight, tyres that are thinner than bicycle tyres, steering that works on the flick of a wrist, just huge fun. I've never smiled or laughed more driving a car than an MG Midget, pound for pound. They're wonderful cars. And not to mention, only one now, they're so well supported. You can wear everything from a badge up to a body shell. The A series, you can tune it, rebuild it, supercharge it, race it, do whatever you want. You can put fiberglass body panels on them. You can fully restore them. You can modify them. You can lower them if you want to. People have done that. And you can get into one, albeit a later one. Again, $5,000 or so will get you in the market. And find me a more fun car for the money. You won't find a more fun car for the money. MG Midget is still, I'd say it's my favourite sports car, and it's one of my favourite cars, period. They're just brilliant.
You've always been very consistent in your admiration of the MG Midget, and quite rightly so. It's a fabulous car that stacks up even today as an affordable classic, desirable but not too pretentious, you know, loads you can do with them.
There's a brilliant club for them, as well as the two big MG clubs you've got there, the Midget and Sprite club as well. And it's an excellent club.
Yeah, I just think they're such a fun car for putting a smile. It's one of those cars that even if you're just nipping to the shops in it, you'll come back with a smile on your face.
Yeah, no, agreed. I should imagine along with the Porsche 997, an MG Midget would be part of your dream garage.
Stop, you're painting a picture for me now. Yeah,
there we are.
Keep the topic of dream garage in mind for my third choice. But yeah, what's your sports car of choice, sir?
Well, I have stayed in Abingdon with you, sir, because I've also gone MG, but I've gone with the MG BGT.
Excellent choice.
Which came out in, what, 65? So just over 60 years ago now. The styling of the GT in particular, it's just such a pretty car. And I think they look great today, a bit like you were saying with the MG Midget, Joe. There's still loads you can do with them. And whether you go with a traditional early one with chrome or a later, slightly more ungainly looking rubber bumper model, they're great. Fundamentally, it's a good car. And there's so much you can do with them, whether you want to just restore one and keep it largely to standard or do some slight tweaks. They're really good and actually relatively practical. While all the plaudits tend to go for the Roadster because it's a drop-top sports car, the GT for me just is a little bit cooler.
Yeah, and cheaper and more practical. Yeah, that's a great choice. And yeah. I think if you're in the world of old cars like us, it's easy for familiarity to breed a bit of contempt, because I hadn't driven an MGB for a little while until I drove one for that Living With video I did last year. And I came back again with a massive smile on my face. You forget how good they are. If you're around old cars all the time, you forget how good the MGB still is.
Yeah,
they feel younger than their years at times, don't they?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. It ticks a lot of boxes for me. So anyway, so we've all chosen a sensible family car and we've all chosen a sports car. And I think we should have the chance to go a bit wild, stray away from a 20 grand budget or anything like that, and just go crazy. Do whatever you like. So Jeff, your without brief 1960 icon is, drumroll,
a supercar.
Whoa. Those of you that said Jeff is always too grounded, here we go.
I would pick a Lamborghini Miura. It's probably the most beautiful car ever produced. So, of course, a pioneering car, the first real performance mid-engined rear-wheel drive car of its type, transverse engine, nice and compact, and just then clothed in this incredible Bertone bodywork. And of course, I'm a huge fan of the Italian job, so I remember the opening scene when Beckerman is in his Miura, his orange Miura, with his shades on, cruising around the Alps. I wouldn't want to do the bit where I hit the digger. But other than that, you know, the rest of it, produced it into the early 70s with revisions. But I went to the Lamborghini Museum a few years back, and there's a silver one in there. There's an early one as well. And it's just, I immediately put a post on social media just saying, is this the most beautiful car in the world? And no one disagreed.
Yeah.
It's just, so I mean, gorgeous. Yes, you're going to need 1.2 million at least to buy one. So that'll never happen. But is it just, you know, if you want a pinnacle of beauty and clever engineering and all those things, I think it's the one.
Gorgeous.
I sold it to you. Yeah.
I can't disagree. It's certainly the car that put Lamborghini on the map, right? And you know, it firmly cemented them as a supercar maker.
One thing I like about the Miura is that inherently it's still got that Italian kind of form over function in some ways. Like that gorgeous nose, like the upset thing. In the early cars, what it actually did was allow air under it. So as you go faster, the front end gets light. But it looks cool, so who cares? And yeah, I don't think there is a car of the era, certainly not a supercar, that's as gorgeous as that. So I applaud that. Very cool.
Without wanting to reveal too much of my own music preferences, I'm sure one appeared in a Kylie video.
In a what?
In a Kylie Minogue video.
I prefer to think of sort of Italian Job, Matt Munro, all that kind of stuff, you know.
This is the difference, isn't it? You're referring to a lovely cultural icon film of the late 60s, and I'm talking about early noughties bubblegum pop. But yes, she obviously couldn't get the beauty of the Lamborghini Miura out of her head.
Welcome to the best classic car and early 2000s pop podcast.
Yes.
Yes.
Classics World and Kylie. That's a collab, isn't it?
Yes.
I imagine.
I should be so lucky. Anyway.
Very good.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Joe, your final wildcard choice.
So, Jeff, you said you thought the Miura is the most beautiful car in the world. Well, I will offer up my choice as the most beautiful car in the world, which is the Citroën DS. Now, I'm sure plenty of you will be jumping in the comments now to point out that it came out in 1955, and you'd be absolutely right. However, my preferred variant of DS, which is what's known as the shark nose, where they went to the fared-in headlights, which far more modern look, and obviously the famous lights that turn with the steering, came out in 1967. So on a technicality, I'm going to call that a 60s car, specifically in convertible, guys, the DS Decapotable. So the factory convertible, there were some aftermarket ones. It was a factory from Citroën themselves, convertible DS with the facelifted front end, utterly beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I didn't pick that because I couldn't pronounce it. So
yeah, I've had three takes of this already, but yeah, just gorgeous car. We know what makes the DS fabulous, the engineering and the suspension and the fluid ride and everything else, but take the roof off and it just gets even classier, even more gorgeous, even more eye-catching, and just for me, the most glamorous, wonderful car. You could still put it on the front cover of Vogue today and it would still look correct. By contrast to your Lamborghini, a bargain, because you can buy one for around £100,000, £150,000. That is around four times what the equivalent saloon will cost you. But for me, that is the most stylish car that the 1960s ever produced. Do drop your comments about E-types down below.
You might have just stolen my thunder a little bit there, Joe, but that's all right.
Sorry, we'll beep that.
It's absolutely fine, because that is my third choice. So a wild card, only in as much as it breaks our previously imposed £20,000 budget. And that is, I have gone with the Jaguar E-Type. But crucially, I'd go with a 4.2 Roadster. 4.2 is the better version of the breed.
I think that's true.
With the better gearbox. For me, the E-Type is probably one of those poster cars that epitomizes the 60s. If you sort of, that whole phrase, the swinging 60s, is kind of minis and E-Types sauntering down the King's Road in Chelsea and all that kind of era. That vibe, that kind of carefree style, a kind of breakaway from post-war austerity. That's what the Jaguar E-Type is all about. It's sort of gorgeous styling. It's devil may care styling that's just, you know, even got the raise the eyebrows of Enzo Ferrari and all this sort of stuff. All those legends that have made the E-Type what it is. It makes absolute sense as an icon of the 60s. So a 4.2 Jaguar E-Type Roadster for me is a kind of 60s icon that I would love. I would happily have all three of those choices on my driveway and enjoy them in equal measure.
Definitely. Well, there you go. You know, Classics World is successful when we have a Miura, DS, and E-Type road trip.
Yes, I'm quite pleased that that Jeff, who often gets slated as our man of the people, how egalitarian with his very base model choices, comes up with a Lamborghini Miura, shows that your tastes are, if nothing, but eclectic.
It's because it's got a transverse engine like a Mini.
Yeah, it's just a big Mini, basically.
Yeah.
On a complete,
and it's got. I think you sort of the gearbox is kind of integral as well. So it's like, you know,
it is just a big Mini, isn't it? You fit all the system even then.
Backwards Mini, okay.
Well, that was a great throwback to a bygone era, a good era nonetheless. Yes, time to move on to what we're up to in the near future. So yes, we're breaking into August, which would have been New Reg Day, of course, back in the
It's sad, isn't it?
That's no longer there. No longer did you. Well, I used to drive around pointing out all the new regs from first.
C reg escort laser.
Yep, all that kind of stuff. That's all gone. But what are we up to in the near future? What about you, Jeff?
Preparation, really. I'm driving to France in a classic Mini.
Nice.
I was hoping to have the city all ready and prepared, and it won't happen. So I'm going to take my trusty Mini Sprite that I've had for 20 years, and I've just got to do a few little jobs like find out why it shakes like crazy under braking, which is always frustrating. That's about it, really. Oil change, service, sort the idle speed out. Woohoo! Alsace, here we come.
Excellent.
Alsace as well. Beautiful. What a lovely part of the world. Very good choice. What about you, Jeff?
Alsace, here we try. You know, it's kind of Alsace or bust, isn't it? That's kind of what we're aiming.
What about you, Joe?
Similarly, tinkering on small cars. My Fiat Seicento, I've embarrassingly failed the MOT this week. So this weekend, we've got to have it in bits. A brake pipe. I think the words, it failed on a corroded brake pipe, and the words the tester used were, my personal opinion is do not drive on that. So that needs changing. I've got some emissions related things to get on top of, which again, we've talked about modern classics and emissions. This is another one. And there's little other odds and sods that need sorting. It's not going to be criminally expensive. It's just an inconvenience. Just because it's a smaller car doesn't mean it's less of a headache. But yeah, we'll persevere. We'll get on. And meantime, I'll try and get some other bits of trim or whatever painted for it. But yeah, muddling on. And my bucket seats that I've previously alluded to have made it even more fun. So yeah, I'm keen to be back out and annoying the neighbours very soon. But very what about good. Yourself, Mr. Widdham?
Well, I finally got the Audi TT back after quite an exhaustive search, literally, for an exhaust. The back box and centre section was a work of a few weeks in the end to find one. There was a main dealer that was selling one for about twice the price of an aftermarket part, which we kind of swerved in the end and found one that the garage I use was willing to fit, because there are ones out there. Don't go with those because they're just a nightmare to fit and they won't fit properly and it will take ages and blah, blah. So anyway, so it's finally back. So I'm definitely going to make a point this weekend of going out for a little drive in that, because it's been long overdue. And other than that, relatively quiet, because I've got a couple of spare weekends before we go into a really busy period, because I just wanted to flag we've got the weekend of the 15th and 16th of August, which for us is super busy because we've got two events in the same weekend. So on the Saturday of the 15th of August, I'm planning to head up to our new spiritual home of Tatton Park up in Cheshire for our third of our three classic car events, the Classic and Retro Car Revival. I'm really hoping to get up there for the Saturday, because on the Sunday, I'm then down at Silverstone for Trax, which is our kind of modified car event. So not necessarily the sort of event of choice for Classics World, at least, but I am quite excited because at Trax, we are going to have a hot hatch hero display to coincide with the 50th anniversary of the Mark 1 Golf GTI. We're going to have a celebration of all hot hatches. So I believe we've curated an absolutely pin sharp collection of hot hatches through the ages, from Renault 5 GT Turbo Raider editions, 205 GTIs and Golf GTIs and many more.
I heard on the grapevine there might be a Citroen BX GTI there.
Don't rule it out. Yes, watch this space. So very excited by that. We're also celebrating 25 years of the, in quotes, new Mini. So we're having a little celebration of that at Trax as well. So a couple of things for the Classics World audience to get their teeth into. So I'm hoping to be there for that. But I need to just quickly give another plug to one of our regular Bookazine output. So our Bookazine of the week is a Jaguar in the 1980s, which is a fresh out Bookazine. Jaguar kind of made a bit of a bounce back in the 80s, almost in spite of itself. It had no new cars to talk of course, but they managed to produce the Series 3 XJ, and the XJS came of age. And therefore, under John Egan's stewardship, Jaguar kind of broke away from the perhaps slightly dour days of the 70s and had these lovely cars that had no right to be surviving into the 80s, but did, and were tremendously successful, such that they ended up come 1989, selling more cars than they'd ever done before, and obviously about to be snapped up for a vast sum of money, $1.6 billion, I think it was, by Ford. So Jaguar in the 80s is a fantastic and very fascinating period in its history. And that book, Jaguar in the 1980s, aims to reflect on all of that. So do check it out. But
if you're on YouTube, link in the description.
Indeed. Thank you very much. Yeah, great. So on to our want of the week. What car has caused us all to do a bit of curious and frankly pointless man maths? So, Jeff, what's your car?
I went a bit highbrow with the Euro, didn't I? So back to Fords. It was at a car meet the other week, and I saw a Mark III Capri roll in. And I know we've talked about them on this podcast before and how certain people think they're overrated. But the presence of that car, specifically, I want an early 2.8 injection when they were two-tone and they had pepper pots. Remember those? So they're one of the early, I think they're four-speed, the early ones. And it was like a light metallic green over grey. I don't know what the Ford colour is, but it's very much like the Austin Rover Opaline shade. So like a sort of kind of pale metallic green over the grey with the sort of red accents on it. And like I say, the pepper pot wheels just looked really cool. Really of its time.
Yeah, it's a very good looking car.
I like the sort of the first 2.8 eyes like that.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Yes,
I've been looking for one. I can't find one for sale in that spec, but
a lot of the later ones seem to have survived, don't they? The sort of mid 80s.
Yeah, with the 2.8 eye injection special tends to survive, and obviously there's quite a lot of Brooklands around still because people treasured those from day one, didn't they? But this is the very first, either the very first of the 2.8 eyes or a very late 3-liter S in like signal orange. Would be pretty cool. So one of those two.
Even I can't deny the cool factor of that.
You're one to the week, sir.
I saw one in the real world and thought, ooh, and then ended up searching for them. I saw a BMW E30 Touring, E33 Series Touring, and thought, ooh, and sure enough, I found one. There you go, on good old Facebook Marketplace. It's a 1990 325i Touring manual in what looks like lovely condition, it must be said. And that's $7,995.
That's cheap.
I know. For how much cool you get, I think that's a bit of a bargain. And it is the one you want, the 2.5 manual. As a Touring, the E30 doesn't actually make a huge amount of sense because it's not that much bigger than a saloon. You know, the roof is slightly tapered, the rear lights cut into the boot openings. You haven't actually got that big of a load space. But it's cool. It looks fantastic.
It was never meant to be, was it? It's kind of a skunk.
Yeah, exactly. Project. I believe there might have been some coachable ones or something. But yeah, E30 Touring for me, utterly cool. And I, it's one of those cars, I think it doesn't matter what colour it's in, what spec it's in, it's just cool. And even if you're not into BMW, my girlfriend doesn't like BMWs, but even she's got time for E30s. And I think it's one of those timeless, elegant, classic. If I didn't already have an 80s German car, I'd probably be on the lookout for an E30 because I think they're super cool.
I think it's a really good choice. They look really good. Do they get a bit rusty? Do they get a bit
rusty? A little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, E30s do rust chronically, but if you buy a good one, I haven't got to worry about it.
Did they do a four-wheel drive version?
I believe they did.
Yeah, it was a 325 IX, was it?
325 IX, yeah, the one up for auction a few years ago. Very, very rare car.
But yeah, they weren't right-hand drive.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah. I thought it was European market only, but yeah. That's a proper Q car, if ever I saw one. Something like that. But,
so go on then, which Jaguar are you after this week, sir?
Right, so anyway, I am catching up with the BBC series Race Across the World. It's a great show. I urge you all to watch it because it's just a lovely validation of all that's good in humanity in an ever divisive world. Go and watch this and see people just getting on from all different backgrounds and just sharing common good. It's a lovely kind of really raises your spirits. Besides that, I was watching an episode where they're going through Asia and they were in Malaysia and often jumping into very questionable minicabs, but they're all Protons. And of course, it got me suddenly thinking about Proton and thinking, wow, you don't see Protons around anymore. They once owned Lotus, didn't they? And all that kind of stuff. And then, of course, that then led me down a rabbit hole of finding Protons for sale. You can't really find them. But I did land on a Lotus-engineered Proton Satria GTI.
Ooh, very cool.
I did find one for sale. And it was just lovely. It was up for $5,995.
Wow, that seems like strong money for one of those now.
Yeah, but what you've got there is a rather lovely Lotus-engineered hot hatchback with a really revvy Mitsubishi engine. And a bit modern, but still over 20 years old. A real curiosity, uber rare.
There's some variety there, chaps. A sort of rakish 70s coupe, a cool 80s wagon, and a left field 90s hot hatch.
I think so. And I think that's the perfect place to end our lovely little merry-go-round of chat. So thank you, gentlemen. And as ever, for you guys at home that are watching or listening, thank you very much for your continued support. Do give us a thumbs up, a like, and a subscribe if you're watching it on YouTube, and get involved in the comments. What would your 60s icon of choice be? I'm sure there's many others we've not listed which we could have applied, and try and pick a sports car or a family car, and then go crazy with a wild card as well while you're at it. And if you're listening on a podcast platform of choice, give us a follow, a rating, and a review. Always good to spread the word, because the more of you can get involved, the better, frankly. So anyway, thanks again, as ever, for joining us. Jeff, Joe, appreciate your time. For you guys at home, thanks again. And we'll see you again soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Cheerio.
Bye-bye.